Welcome to Words to Live By, a podcast series hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. Each week, we will share some of the wit and wisdom of Ronald Reagan. In essence, Words to Live By, made up of radio addresses and speeches he delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. President Reagan's disappointment and distrust of international organizations is vividly apparent in his radio commentaries from 1975 to 1980. Today, when we look at the situation in Ukraine, the tragedies unfolding in Gaza, you can't help but wonder what, if anything, the United Nations actually has accomplished in bringing peace to the world. On March 25th, just a month ago, the UN Security Council passed a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan, in addition to the immediate and unconditional release of hostages and the urgent need to expand the flow of aid into Gaza. There were 14 votes in favor, with the U.S. abstaining. As of this writing, the parties involved, Israel and Hamas, are talking, and, well, we're hopeful. It was Dag Hammarskjöld, the second UN general, who said it best. The United Nations, he said, was created not to lead mankind to heaven, but to save humanity from hell. The kind of hell that Hammarskjöld had in mind was not hard to imagine in the wake of World War II and Hitler's extermination camps, and with the atom bomb's shadow spreading across the globe. In almost 80 years, the United Nations may have been hailed as the great hope for the future of mankind, but it has also been dismissed as a shameful den of dictatorships. It's infuriated nations with its numbing bureaucracy, its institutional cover-ups of corruption, and the undemocratic policies of its Security Council. It goes to the war in the name of peace, but it's been a bystander through genocide. So in this podcast, we'll listen to two of Ronald Reagan's speeches, an excerpt from a 1983 address where his highly aggressive rhetoric was criticized, and a radio address from 1978. Both clarify why he believed that the UN, despite its lofty goals, is impotent. To put this speech in context, it was given in September 1983, after the shooting of Korean airliner 007 by the Soviet Union, which President Reagan characterized as a massacre. Let's listen.
Arms control requires a spirit beyond narrow national interests. This spirit is a basic pillar on which the UN was founded. We seek a return to this spirit. A fundamental step would be a true non-alignment of the United Nations. This would signal a return to the true values of the Charter, including the principle of universality. The members of the United Nations must be aligned on the side of justice rather than injustice, peace rather than aggression, human dignity rather than subjugation. Any other alignment is beneath the purpose of this great body and destructive of the harmony that it seeks. What harms the Charter harms peace. The founders of the UN expected that member nations would behave and vote as individuals after they had weighed the merits of an issue, rather like a great global town meeting. The emergence of blocs and the polarization of the UN undermine all that this organization initially valued. We must remember that the non-aligned movement was founded to counter the development of blocs and to promote détente between them. Its founders spoke of the right of smaller countries not to become involved in others' disagreements. Since then, membership in the non-aligned movement has grown dramatically, but not all the new members have shared the founders' commitment of genuine non-alignment. Indeed, client governments of the Soviet Union, who have long since lost their independence, have flocked into the non-aligned movement and once inside have worked against its true purpose. Pseudo-non-alignment is no better than pseudo-arms control. The United States rejects as false and misleading the view of the world as divided between the empires of the East and West. We reject it on factual grounds. The United States does not head any bloc of subservient nations, nor do we desire to. What is called the West is a free alliance of governments, most of whom are democratic, and all of whom greatly value their independence. What is called the East is an empire directed from the center, which is Moscow. The United States today, as in the past, is a champion of freedom and self-determination for all people. We welcome diversity. We support the right of all nations to define and pursue their national goals. We respect their decisions and their sovereignty, asking only that they respect the decisions and sovereignty of others. Just look at the world over the last 30 years and then decide for yourself whether the United States or the Soviet Union has pursued an expansionist policy. Today, the United States contributes to peace by supporting collective efforts by the international community. We give our unwavering support to the peacekeeping efforts of this body, as well as other multilateral peacekeeping efforts around the world. The UN has a proud history of promoting conciliation and helping keep the peace. Today, UN peacekeeping forces or observers are present in Cyprus and Kashmir, on the Golan Heights, and in Lebanon. In addition to our encouragement of international diplomacy, the United States recognizes its responsibilities to use its own influence for peace. From the days when Theodore Roosevelt mediated the Russo-Japanese War in 1905, we have a long and honorable tradition of mediating or damping conflicts and promoting peaceful solutions. In Lebanon, we, along with France, Italy, and the United Kingdom, have worked for a ceasefire, for the withdrawal of all external forces, and for restoration of Lebanon's sovereignty and territorial integrity. In Chad, we have joined others in supporting the recognized government in the face of external aggression. In Central America, as in Southern Africa, we are seeking to discourage reliance upon force and to construct a framework for peaceful negotiations. We support a policy to disengage the major powers from third world conflict. The UN Charter gives an important role to regional organizations in the search for peace. The U.S. efforts in the cause of peace are only one expression of a spirit that also animates others in the world community. The Organization of American States was a pioneer in regional security efforts. In Central America, the members of the Contadora Group are striving to lay a foundation for peaceful resolution of that region's problems. In East Asia, the Asian countries have built a framework for peaceful political and economic cooperation that has greatly strengthened the prospects for lasting peace in their region. In Africa, organizations such as the Economic Community of West African States are being forged to provide practical structures in the struggle to realize Africa's potential. From the beginning, our hope for the United Nations has been that it would reflect the international community at its best. The UN at its best can help us transcend fear and violence and can act as an enormous force for peace and prosperity. Working together, we can combat international lawlessness and promote human dignity. If the governments represented in this chamber want peace as genuinely as their peoples do, we shall find it. We can do so by reasserting the moral authority of the United Nations. In recent weeks, the moral outrage of the world seems to have reawakened. Out of the billions of people who inhabit this planet, why, some might ask, should the death of several hundred shake the world so profoundly? Why should the death of a mother flying toward a reunion with her family, or the death of a scholar heading toward new pursuits of knowledge, matter so deeply? Why are nations who lost no citizens in the tragedy so angry? The reason rests on our assumptions about civilized life and the search for peace. The confidence that allows a mother or a scholar to travel to Asia or Africa or Europe or anywhere else on this planet may be only a small victory in humanity's struggle for peace. Yet what is peace if not the sum of such small victories? Today, at the beginning of this 38th session, I solemnly pledge my nation to upholding the original ideals of the United Nations. Our goals are those that guide this very body. Our ends are the same as those of the UN's founders, who sought to replace a world at war with one where the rule of law would prevail, where human rights were honored, where development would blossom, where conflict would give way to freedom from violence.
After this speech, the Washington Post critical of Ronald Reagan's confrontational approach, said that the United Nations baiting was the Reagan administration's favorite international sport. However, the Post did continue to say that on any given day, quote, the United Nations looks less like the last great hope for peace and more like a squalid bully pulpit from which rinky-dink mini-states can bully-rag America. It is a politically stacked deck. The United States is often at the mercy of a majority of international juvenile delinquents. We'll be right back after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now, back to the story. Back in 1978, Governor Reagan wrote a radio address, frustrated by those members of the UN who do not pay their dues, based on the idea that, well, they don't agree with the actions the UN has taken, so they won't and don't pay. This radio address is called No Pay, No Vote. Let's listen.
Why shouldn't nations, like people, be posted for not paying their dues? Custom and tradition require members of an organization to be paid up or lose voting rights. I'll be right back. It goes without saying that the United States has proven its generosity again and again. Other nations owe us tens of billions of dollars, but they aren't asked to pay up. We're first on the scene to bring aid when natural disaster strikes, and our Marshall Plan and subsequent foreign aid program are unique in all history. We helped allies and erstwhile enemies alike, with need being the only criteria, all of which qualifies us now to make a long overdue move in the United Nations. A United Nations peacekeeping force in Lebanon is estimated to cost $68 million in the first 6 months. The United Nations is already $166 million in debt for other peacekeeping chores, going all the way back to 1948 and including the UN Emergency Force in Sinai from 1956 to 67, the Congo operation in 1960 to 64, and the current observer force activities in the Middle East. We've paid our share for all these UN undertakings. Besides, we pay a fourth or more of the entire United Nations budget. The Soviet Union and its satellite states have refused to pay some $82 million in assessments for their share of these UN activities. They claim that since they disapprove of the actions, they don't have to pay. Back in 1964, there was quite a fuss when the United States and several Western powers threatened to invoke charter sanctions and deny voting rights to the delinquent nations. Unfortunately, we only threatened. It therefore should come as no surprise to us that the Soviet Union has made plain that it has no intention of supporting the peacekeeping force in Lebanon, that it is opposed to the functions of the force, and believes Israel should be made to pay the entire cost. This should bring the Soviet unpaid bill up to $100 million or more. The Soviets even refused to consider the creation of a permanent United Nations peacekeeping fund. A UN financial expert has been quoted as saying, "If anything brings down the United Nations, I think the financial tangle will." I'll refrain from expressing an opinion on whether that would be good or bad, but one thing does need doing. If a club member, or in many cases a union member, is delinquent in his dues, he loses privileges, including the right to vote, till he pays up. Since the United States holds the unchallenged record for financial responsibility in the UN, why shouldn't our ambassador officially move that voting rights be denied the Soviet Union, and this time make it stick? If they threaten to pack up and go home, what will have been lost? Can anyone remember a single instance in which the Soviet Union has contributed anything of lasting value? The Korean War, we tend to forget, was fought under the UN flag with the Soviet Union lending comfort and aid to the enemy. If the United Nations would take such an action, it might acquire a soul. If it refuses, then we could take a walk and discover we still have one. This is Ronald Reagan. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit ReaganFoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Words to Live By podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of Words to Live By come out every Tuesday. Like what you hear? Check out our A Reagan Forum podcast featuring great speeches delivered at the Reagan Library. New episodes drop every Thursday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan 40 on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.